There have been many interesting unforeseen trends in the way this coronavirus pandemic has managed to play out, and there are many to talk about, but I want to highlight two of them today as they relate to climate change. One is that science has taken center stage in a White House that has historically been overtly anti-science. And the second trend is that greenhouse gas emissions have gone way down with, of course, the economy shut down and nobody going anywhere, which buys us a bit more time to take mitigating action to thwart climate change. So what do these trends mean for what happens next and what we do next? Today, we're going to find out from a woman at the forefront of these issues as she leads a prestigious global nonprofit that is focused on keeping science in decision making, especially about climate change and the environment. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women about corporate responsibility, energy, and sustainability-related issues. I'm Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts, maybe wherever you found us today, or on our website, greenconnectionsradio.com, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you're struggling with your own career, especially in this crisis when everything is in upheaval, please reach out to us and let us know through Twitter, LinkedIn, or the Contact Us page on our website. We can help you no matter what industry you're in. It's a stressful time, so be kind to yourself and do take care. Science is dominating our conversations and inputs these pandemic days as we try to figure out what's true, what isn't, where we are on the continuum of the pandemic, what actions to take in our own lives, careers, and businesses, and when we might have vaccines or treatments for the virus. It's a refreshing turn of events in our culture, frankly, which for the past few years has been dominated by an administration that is decidedly anti-science. I, for one, am grateful that science-based decision-making is back, though I wish it did not take a pandemic, of course, to get there. So how can we leverage this moment to keep the ravages of climate change at bay? That's one of the questions for our esteemed guest today. I'd like you to meet Michelle Wyman, Executive Director of the National Council of Science and the Environment, or NCSE, a global nonprofit dedicated to keeping science in decision-making from policy to practice. They work with universities, companies, and government agencies, and Michelle has worked on energy and climate policy with states and local governments for over 15 years. She's been developing strategic and tactical solutions to their energy planning, climate mitigation, and adaptation challenges. And before NCSE, she held leadership roles at the U.S. Department of Energy, the World Bank, and the United Nations, as well as at other nonprofits. Full disclosure, I have known NCSE for many years and spoken at several of their conferences. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Michelle, and thank you for joining us, especially at this stressful time.
Thank you so much for having me, Joan.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So let's start with answering the question I posed in my introduction. We all hope this renewed focus on science-based decision-making sticks around a while. But we also know that this administration does not believe in climate change and, in fact, supports the fossil fuel industry, as we've seen in their many regulatory rollbacks regarding environmental policy and regulations. So what can we do to keep science in the conversation going forward?
I think it's a really important question in being proactive in harnessing the moment that we find ourselves in, where science is very much, as you've shared, at the center point of the daily shifting response that is informing the decisions not only that our leaders are making, but also the decisions that citizens are making, communities are making, and up the scale. We have spent the last, NCSE was established in 1990, 30 years, looking for opportunities to bridge the decision-making and scientific communities to one another under conditions that are not moments of crisis. Clearly, today, the time that we find ourselves in is, once again, crisis response. But we do need to harness the highlight that science is having right now. So our part of our plan in doing that going forward, and I'm going to give you some very concrete examples, is to establish a series of virtual roundtables as one concrete example, where we're bringing together groups of epidemiologists from different universities in particular regions and hosting virtual, essentially town halls that are open to the public between those scientists and local decision makers, cities and city and county elected officials, to focus on public health, COVID-19, impacts to ecosystems, and all of that in a place-based context. And it's one way that we hope will facilitate more comfortability after we have all successfully waved goodbye to this pandemic period. We will create a lasting bridge between the scientific communities in place and decision makers that are leading in those same places. Another example of work that we hope will essentially fortify the boundary spanning function between science and policy. Our science policy director, Dr. Erica Goldman, often likes to say the science push and the policy pull is part of the way we think about our work, is to continue to facilitate specific topically focused opportunities that bring the data and the analysis out of the most current science to bear in some of the frontline issues that decision makers are dealing with outside of the context of COVID-19, of course. So this is more in the proactive, kind of normal, under normal conditions.
What do you mean? I'm sorry, what do you mean by that? Explain that a little bit.
So let's say a lot of local governments right now and state governments, and I'm talking, of course, in a domestic context, but this is really applicable all over the world, are trying to figure out how to better ready their communities, both from a physical infrastructure perspective all the way over to their response mechanisms and their reconstruction mechanisms to the changing climate system. So essentially to design resilience plans that cover the span of readiness, response, and reconstruction. And we are aiming and we work to bring decision makers and scientists out of local universities and those decision makers from those same places together. We are also bringing increasingly insurance industry leaders, risk finance experts to the table to help cities and counties and states, subnational governments, take a look at resilience plans they have in place, emergency response plans they have in place, how they might correlate, where science can help bring more cohesion to the plans that they have, and how it can be applied over the course of an extreme weather event, whether it's a hurricane, a firestorm, or an extended heat event or an extended drought event. And that's a really solid example of the science policy interface work. We call it science policy boundary spanning. That is one of our longer term streams of work that's been in place now for almost 2 years that continues to grow. And it's Joan, it's a really terrific way to bring together the assets of the scientific community with leaders at the local level who are looking eagerly for forward action and proactive policies that anticipate and take into account projections that are informed by science.
Mm-hmm. So we're seeing, unfortunately, writ large, what emergency management systems are in place at the local, at all levels, right? Local, state, county, regional, and federal. How are the emergency management systems we're seeing, or frankly not seeing in some cases, now in this pandemic teaching you and these local governments and others about what they can do or need to fix or need to adjust to prepare for climate change disasters?
Well, I think one of the most significant lessons that we are learning right now, currently, is the importance of pairing the rigor and the stability, the certainty that science brings to addressing a crisis in real time. Whether that's a climate crisis, a weather event, or the pandemic that we find ourselves in from a public health perspective, science brings certainty and can help better and in an accelerated way for inform responses by decision makers. I think, you know, one of the lessons that we're all watching is the challenges of the role that politics and partisan politics play in how policy making and decision making is made mm-hmm. under these current conditions. And again, I think science, you know, science isn't politics. And when science is politicized, we immediately weaken the integrity that it can contribute to durable policies. And I think in those states, particularly where we're seeing this extraordinary level of leadership coming from state houses, from our governors in particular, in responding to the current pandemic, you can see a lot of the decisions that they're making were made early and proactively based on the science that they were using and leaning into mm-hmm. to inform in the absence of a strong, cohesive national policy or a national set of responses and recommendations.
Right. But to say that politics is infiltrating policy is redundant, because that's what policy is. It's done by politicians, right? Ultimately.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And my point was to not allow, not that politics are involved in policy, of course they are, but to actually try to not politicize science, to mm-hmm. not use science as a political weapon. That was my point. Rather, to allow science to do what it does best, to serve as a strong foundation to inform policy and decision making.
So with a, it's kind of an interesting time in this country, because historically you wouldn't have had to do that, right? Science has historically been our common language, that facts were the basis for mutual understanding. We don't have that now. We have it right this second in some ways with the pandemic. But again, as you point out, it's not consistent across the board. But you also, in order to get legislation passed, especially at the federal level, which is where it has the most impact, although there's huge impact locally as well, of course, you need to talk to an administration, or even at the state level, some states, the local governments, the local state governments, do not believe in science or don't listen to science because they put ideology first. So how do you talk to those people? How do you bring science into the discussion with people who don't value it?
So maybe I can answer your question with an experience earlier in my career that I think will put a very fine point on the answer that I give you. I would say almost 15 years ago now, maybe even a little while longer, I was working at an international nonprofit focused very specifically on local governments, local government leadership, and mayors. And when I say this, I led one of 13 country-based offices for an international nonprofit. And we worked together to design a strategy to engage international recognition of the importance of local action in effectively addressing climate change and curbing the growth of greenhouse gases. And And so we targeted mayors as our primary level of decision making and the people that we wanted to work with directly. And here in the United States, which was the primary geographical area of the focus of the office that I was leading, we looked across the states. And, you know, it's interesting that at the local level, you often don't know the politics, the party of an elected official, of a mayor. But you can make some assumptions based on place. And, you know, almost 20 years ago when I was doing this work, like I said, it's a little bit more than 15 years ago, there was a really interesting moment in time where we saw a significant pivot by mayors who initially were viewed as a level of elected decision makers who were not really engaged in the climate issue, pivot to really be leading the frontline response on climate change here in the United States. And I think we could argue there were other countries that also had an equivalent experience.
What caused them to pivot?
Well, that's what I was just going to share. So in order to actually engage mayors at scale here in the U.S., we had to touch every state. And as you know, different states have kind of a general, let's say, political character. So one of our targeted states was the state I grew up in, the state of Texas. So you could probably make some strong assumptions about the general political lean in the state and make some additional assumptions based on that about the general political lean of mayors in the state. And I was really studying the mayor from who at the time was in office at the city where I grew up, Arlington, Texas. And Arlington now is just shy of 1 million, maybe even a little more, home to the baseball stadium for the Texas Rangers, and really sits kind of almost equidistant between Dallas and Fort Worth. So I studied this mayor because I needed to figure out how I could find an anchor mayor in the state of Texas. And that was part of our strategy, finding a lead mayor who could then engage additional mayors in each state and every territory. I looked at his background, and he served both as mayor and also as the president of the largest hospital in Arlington. And in my prep for my first meeting with him, I also took some time to look at his platform, at the issues that he ran his campaign on, and really took time to understand what he cared about. Once I understood that he was a doctor and he was president, a trained doctor and president of the hospital, I looked at his campaign platform. It was clear that public health was a priority for him. So I did my research. I met with him in the first meeting. And initially, when we sat down, he made it very clear to me within the first 5 minutes that he did not want to have a conversation about climate change. And if I was there to meet with him to discuss climate change, it was going to be a short meeting. So I made it really clear to him that I was there to talk with him about his political legacy, why he ran for local office, what he wanted his legacy to be. And as we started to engage together in a deeper conversation, and really, you know, it's relationship building. I had the opportunity before the end of the meeting, once he had shared with me why he had become president of the hospital and had stopped actually practicing medicine. And I also could understand from him directly why he chose public health as one of his top campaign priorities, I pulled out of my bag the most current asthma rates in town and started to show him, based on a map, how some of the development plans for the cities out of the city's planning department put at risk the health of the residents that would be living in those residential areas that were planned to be built near major thoroughfares, and what the health risks and health impacts might be if they were to be approved. So we built our relationship essentially around criteria air pollutants and air quality.
So how did he respond?
He was really interested. And it took another couple of meetings, Joan. And by the third meeting, I finally felt like it was the right moment to say, you know, there's a co-benefit to this work. If you pass more rigorous planning regulations and you apply stronger standards to your zoning and permitting processes to protect public health, you are also going to be reducing greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change. And I remember clear as day him looking at me, and I smiled at him. And by this point, we had built some trust between us. We'd built a bit of a relationship. And I said it before he could say it to me. I said, you know, I know you told me that you wouldn't want to have a long conversation with me if I was going to talk to you about climate change. I'm not asking you to believe in it. I'm sharing with you that your strong leadership in managing and protecting the public health of the community that you serve as mayor to is also going to have a co-benefit to reduce not only air pollution, but also to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. No harm. And I'm not asking you to say out loud that you believe that the climate is changing. And it worked. And he started to invest in this work. And within 1 year, not a long time, he worked with me closely enough that he became the strongest mayoral champion initially in the state of Texas. He was a loud, outspoken Republican. He rallied additional mayors, both Democrats and Republicans in the state. I believe at one point there were 32 mayors involved in Texas, including all of the largest cities, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, San Antonio, Austin, all working together. And they were working together on climate change. He pivoted entirely from an air quality frame to a climate change frame, and he became a champion. And all of that was based on science. It was based on the data that I started in when I was building relationship with him at the earliest stage. So I think that answers your question.
It does. It's a very good example. What I want to pull out from that is, A, you did your research on him and on his pet projects and on the impact of the on the community of those projects or potential impact from an environmental standpoint. B, you therefore focused on data points that would resonate with his value system and with areas of policy that he had overtly expressed were priorities for him. And obviously, as a doctor, you would think would be those priorities. And C, you didn't lead with that. You didn't lead with where he was resistant. You led with, let me tell you about the impact on your community of these things you're talking about from, and let me tell you about it from an angle you might not have considered. And also that you took the time to nurture the discussion. You probably had to hold yourself back at the end of that first meeting from saying, oh, I'm on a roll, maybe I should bring it up, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, there is an art. And as a journalist and a communicator, I think you understand this certainly better than I do and better than many. There is an art to understanding the nuances of in the cadence of relationship building, particularly when your motivation is driven by issues that from a scientific perspective are beyond compelling, like climate change. So it's really hard to hold back.
Oh, it is. I find it difficult all the time. Sometimes I literally stick a pencil in my mouth to keep myself from saying something. And this is a good segue because one of the sessions that I attended at NCSC's 2020 conference in January, I bet you're glad it was in January, was on how to communicate with Congress on a lot of these issues. And the panel of congressional staffers and experts, they made a lot of great points, of course, but their overarching point was that the environmental community and the scientific community does not communicate well with Congress. That the science and the academic communities tend to come in with data points, et cetera, that aren't really relevant to the member. They don't really speak to the member's values. So they said that the communication needs to be more tailored to the priorities of the members and their staffs, as well as the topic du jour. So right now, obviously, it's the pandemic. So how can we use your experience with that mayor? How can we talk about these issues to gain support for policies at the federal level as well as at the local level that protect the environment, increase resilience, and mitigate climate change risks? What can we learn from your experience and to extrapolate to help bridge this gap?
You know, it's great that you asked that. And the answer I'm going to give you is the answer that, you know, if the sky were the limit and I could actually go and do this, I would immediately. And I'll tell you the approach that I would take would be to look at the common denominators, the things that we know both sides of the aisle on the Hill share in common. The priorities we know they care about: public health, we know they care about the economy, we know they care about security. And when I say they, I mean members of Congress, both parties. Mm-hmm. And my approach would be to literally, as I just shared about the mayor in Texas, do my homework. And I'm not kidding, I fantasize about this sometimes because I wonder if it would work. Do my homework on each member of Congress, take their particular priority issues, and it's almost like a puzzle. Mm-hmm. Start to build a strategy for securing their attention on the issues around climate change that would be informed by the lens that they might look at it, where they're not going to come in resistant. They're not going to come in and say, you're telling me what to believe. You're telling me I have to do this. I have to do these five things. And all of them are predicated on the requirement that climate change is happening due to human activity. Rather, to come in and say, here's an array of data and analysis that supports the priorities that you care about. Mm-hmm. And then also link them and tie them to an overarching climate strategy that addresses, again, those common denominators: economy, security, and public health. And it sounds very easy. If it were easy, I'm not the only person who thinks about this and does this work. Many of us do. It would be done. There also is, I think,
You could probably do a spreadsheet of all that, though. You could probably create a spreadsheet of which members have which priorities and therefore which data points would speak to them most.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, LCV has done that very effectively. They do it in the lead up to almost every election.
You mean the League of National Level. LCV being the League of Conservation Voters? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And they do that, you know, state-based and also at the national level. It's done. But the part that is so important to all of this is the relationship building component. And that, Joan, takes time. Mm-hmm. And that's the hardest part. Because you can't, you know, it's interesting. On one hand, I shouldn't say you can't. With the mayor, it took me several months to actually get a meeting confirmed with him. I stayed at it and I was persistent because in the end, if you serve in elected office, part of your obligation is to meet with your constituents. Certainly mayors are more accessible than members of Congress, but it does happen eventually. It takes time. And so I think the relationship component to this, it's almost it's the glue that brings cohesion across the issues. And it enables a different form of listening and a different openness, in my experience, that includes openness to hearing the science.
It reminds me of a story I heard at another conference. I'm trying to remember where I heard it, but a woman I interviewed who heads up the Smart Cities or Metro Cities 21 or something like that, Smart Cities Institute at Carnegie Mellon, Karen Lightman, talked about a community that went to their city council trying to get a power plant shut down. And they came in and they just said, you know, we have all these rates of asthma, or we have, you know, these problems, this is bad for the community, shut it down. And the council basically looked at them blankly and said, you know, come back with proof. So what they did was they went out and they collected the data. They tracked the relationship between asthma rates, ER visits, and the plant's activities. And they came in 6 or 9 months or so later and said, okay, here's your correlation. And the city council freaked out, shut the plant down within a week.
Yeah. And, you know, what I would add to that, you know, if we were just talking about kind of the sequence of that approach, that strategy, I would add to that, if you took that correlation and then showed the cost to date to taxpayers and then the projected costs, mm-hmm. as well as the avoided cost, depending on which direction, and clearly if they shut the plant down, to have those avoided costs in hand to use for reference as a decision maker, as an elected official, when you're talking to whether it's your constituents who put you in office who may initially disagree, mm-hmm. or their sons and their fathers, their mothers, their daughters are employed at the power plants. It's really, really useful to have that data at hand so you can help provide an informed response to someone who may be very emotional, but you can be sympathetic and also give data mm-hmm. that brings a different level of understanding.
So that would be, just to be clear for people who are listening, that would be healthcare costs, productivity costs, economic costs.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, cool.
That's right. That's right. You know, and you can tie that also, I mean, a different example of that, that's kind of more on the spectrum of climate change impacts. A lot of state and local governments right now, and again, this is both domestic, but also across the world, are grappling with their annual budgeting process and the level of investments they should be making to fortify their infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And are they rebuilding a bridge for the 100-year flood when the 100-year flood has already happened 10 times since right. 2000?
Much less a 500-year flood has happened right. in 2000s. Right, right.
Right. And so then, you know, they're making decisions, budgetary decisions that are massive. And the positive outcomes of those decisions may not show up mm-hmm. during their tenure in office.
That's the tricky part, because they might not get the credit, right, right, right. So before I jump, I want to close with a couple of career issues, but a couple of quick things. You and I have talked before, and you've mentioned a couple times about the global cooperation that's needed to mitigate climate change. I had a really interesting conversation with someone recently who told me that this pandemic has demonstrated that countries and governments of the world and private sectors around the globe can come together to solve a common problem when we need to. He said the global mobilization to combat this pandemic shows that it's possible. So nobody can any longer say it's not possible. So how can we leverage this moment to bring the global community together to combat climate change, even with a United States administration that probably wouldn't support it?
I'm going to sound a bit redundant, but I will reiterate that data is okay. the strongest ally that we have in this. And I would, excuse me, I would encourage all of us to spend less time. And it doesn't mean, I'm not trying to understate the difficulties of different political positions on the issue of climate change. And you'll note the way that I'm talking, I've spent my career, Joan, working on very difficult issues that suffer under the burden of being politicized. I forge my work in a bipartisan way. And I think that the distraction in some ways of someone's party politics have really been an Achilles heel for the people that are working on accelerating climate action. Mm-hmm. And I would argue to your question that science is the greatest tool we have to help harness, as you said, the moment in time that we find ourselves in at a global level. Science is the strongest tool of diplomacy. To your point, I want to make sure I get this data point correct for you. Let me read this to you. And it's really quick. It's one sentence. It's important. Nation states have sovereignty, sovereign rights, and jurisdictions across nearly 30% of the Earth. In contrast, international spaces established from World War II beyond sovereign jurisdictions exist across nearly 70% on the Earth as well as in outer space. So essentially, our global commons are 70%, and our sovereign nations and jurisdictions are 30%. On a global scale, across 100% of our home planet, the challenge is to balance national interests and common interests. And that challenge, that's a challenge that we will have as humanity into perpetuity. Mm-hmm. And we will, I remain hopeful, and I'm not trying to be, and I'm not sure if this is a verb, but to Pollyanna the moment, mm-hmm. I remain optimistic that we can overcome the climate challenge. And I think that there will be outcomes from how we address the pandemic right now that can be applied and will continue to help accelerate the response to climate change, because we're proving to each other as a global community that we can stand shoulder to shoulder and take on a challenge like this. And we've done it in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, we manage the Arctic effectively. We manage the Montreal Protocol is probably the strongest example that we have of international cooperation rallying with a very swift response around an extreme acute environmental danger to our ozone.
Mm-hmm. So what are, one more question that I'm going to ask you, a quick career question. What are three things that people listening today can do to keep science in government decision-making and policy-making? What can we as citizens, business leaders, entrepreneurs, community leaders, and academics do? I hear you loud and clear on the data points. I hear you on understanding the agendas of the people you're talking to. But if the public wants to continue to keep science front and center and not lose that momentum, how can we do it? How can we support that effort?
One specific response: build relationship with an elected official in the place where you live. Whether you're an academic, an industry leader, a citizen who has a phenomenal job of raising children, build a relationship with an elected official, understand the issues they care about, and bring the science to them. Highlight the science for them around those issues. Science is in every single one of them. And I think that's actually the strongest answer that I can give you. I also think it's important to recognize that my understanding of science and your understanding of science is different. And what I mean by that is people understand science at varying levels. Some people have studied to be public relations specialists or artists, and they work outside the bounds of traditional science. And it's important to acknowledge that and to understand that science serves everyone in different ways. And story really, really matters. Maintaining a level of accessibility and relatability around the work that you lead and looking actively for how science informs your work so you can then convey that effectively to someone else, not to assert advice on how they should think, but rather to help them appreciate how science can serve them.
So you really, it does. You really want to tune into how science informs their decision making, or could, so that you can help guide that. I like that. So I would say one is build relationships, two is bring the data, and three is understand what the three is tell stories with that data and with your experience that makes you more relatable in the context of how science informs their own decision making. Cool. So a quick career piece of advice we like to give to our listeners. You're obviously an accomplished professional woman who works in a field aligned with her values and interests. So what would you suggest to a woman in mid-career, not just fresh out of college, but someone with, you know, at least 10, 15 or so years of experience who wants to use her education and experience to make a difference?
Oh my goodness. I would stay very clearly focused on remembering not to get boxed in, not to stay in your lane. And what I mean by that, I think it is very easy to unknowingly fall into a rhythm. And for some people, you know, if you decide that you want to be a veterinarian in your career, it may make most sense to stay in the path of veterinary medicine. There may be ways to step outside that lane. There may be complete pivot points where you can go in a totally different direction, and it doesn't need to happen only when you're 25. For me, I spent the majority of my career up until joining NCSE working with elected officials, decision makers, at all levels, from local to international. I had never worked with scientists before. I'd been using science. My background, I'm not a scientist. I'm not educated or trained as a scientist. I'm a trained journalist. And I have a graduate degree in public policy. And when I was approached and invited to consider this position that I have, I initially said to the board, I'm not quite sure if you have the right person. You may have meant to reach out to someone. I'm not a scientist. And to their credit, they said, we're not looking for a scientist. We want someone who understands the policy play and understands decision making. For me, Joan, it was a huge pivot. I blew up the box I was in. I stepped, there wasn't even a lane that I understood I was stepping into when I took this position. And it has been the most extraordinary experience. I have learned more in the 3 years I've been in this role about science and this whole part of life that was so intimidating to me prior to it. And that's why I feel so strongly about the points I just made around keeping science relatable and accessible and using story to communicate, because it's how I've learned and built relationship with incredibly brilliant people in this community who are scientists who are giving us this information. So my advice would be don't be shy to step outside your box, and don't allow the box to become so rigid as you grow in your career that you forget there are possibilities to constantly push at those edges, be creative, and look beyond them. So you can not only satisfy the work that you're doing, but keep your spirit and your heart satisfied in the process.
Oh, I love that. That's great. That reminds me of when I was recruited by Chrysler, because I'd never worked in the automotive field at all. And they told me that was why I was most effective, because I didn't come in jaded by that. But there's one hitch to that, and that is you were lucky that NCSE understood the value that you brought, and I was lucky that Chrysler understood my value. But so often we're applying online or we're meeting someone who then we have to then send them material and that goes through their circuits and somebody along the line, it doesn't fit the keywords or yada, yada. So how do you sell somebody on your ability to make that pivot? You know, you can say, oh, we'll talk about the benefits that you bring, but not everybody understands that. A lot of times they're kind of stuck in the model. I mean, I've run into that myself.
No, you're exactly right. And I don't know that there's a silver bullet to that. And she said, remember not to go through the front door because it's not going to happen that way. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for a position that falls outside of the box or outside of your lane, going through the front door, in other words, applying online or sending your package of credentials and materials, even to someone you know, isn't going to be enough. You've got to establish yourself across that particular sector in that community.
So before we close, I know we need to let you go, but any final thoughts before we let you go?
I would only share, Joan, one, I want to thank you so much for having me and for doing the work that you do and really highlighting the strength and the resilience of women. I'm a bit biased, but I think we're kind of all very extraordinary. And I would also say, not to be completely somber, but I have to say that this moment in time is both riveting and scary, a bit unnerving at times. And also, I've seen some of the most human moments and seen people enjoying nature in ways that I have not seen in decades. So I see light at the end of the tunnel, and I know that we will find our way through this. There will be huge tragedy, and there already has been, but I know we'll find our way through. And I do think that there will be lessons coming out of this that will be underscored by science that will help us then pivot back towards continuing to pursue strong climate action.
Oh, that's great. You know, it's interesting. I think people having to have stayed inside for so long is actually giving them a greater appreciation for nature, too. That's fun. So thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio, Michelle Wyman of the National Council for Science and the Environment. So how are you talking about climate change during this pandemic? What do you wish your government leaders were doing? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it on our Facebook page and ask to join our private Facebook group while you're there. You can also leave it on Apple Podcasts with your review and subscribe to our mailing list on our website to stay abreast of our talented and amazing guests like Michelle, our blogs, and career advice. And if you are struggling with this, your career at this time, please feel free to reach out to me on Twitter. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time, and please stay safe.